Hello everyone and welcome to Singularity 101. Singularity 101 is a podcast feature of Singularity weblog where you can go and listen to it or download it in full. As you may already know, my name is Nicola, aka Socrates, and as always, I will be the man with the questions. Today, I'm privileged to have Werner Vinge as my guest on the show. Known for his rigorous hard science approach, Werner Vinge first became an iconic figure both among cybernetic scientists and science fiction fans with the publication of his 1981 novella True Names, widely considered to be the visionary work behind the Internet Revolution. Later, he gained even more public attention as a Hugo Award winner and the author who coined the term technological singularity in his science fiction novel Marooned in Real Time. So, without further ado, let me welcome Professor Werner Vinge. Hi, Werner, and welcome to Singularity 101.
Hi, Nicola.
Just before we jump into the questions, I want to share with Werner and our audience that I've been actually suffering sick for the last 2 or 3 days, and as a result of that, my voice may sound rather different than usually, so I hope my listeners can bear with that. So anyway, but I wouldn't want to miss such a rare opportunity as to interview Werner Vinge, and that's why I still decided to go ahead with the interview. Anyway, let's begin with the first question here. Werner, can you tell us a little more about yourself and your background, but especially why and how you got interested in issues such as science and advanced technologies in general, and writing science fiction in particular?
Well, since a young child, I've always been interested in things associated with science. And I remember that when I was actually rather slow to learn to read. My parents told me that probably the first book that I ever read all the way through wasn't until the second grade or so. But that book was Robert Heinlein's Between Planets. And one thing that I noticed very early on was that it was very hard in the early 1950s to find stories where the world was different at the end of the story than it was at the beginning of the story. You would occasionally find stories that seemed to be like that, but then at the end the character would wake up and it had all been a dream. So the very rare stories that I could find in that era where the world was different at the end of the story than at the beginning of the story turned out to be pretty uniformly associated with the genre of science fiction. So basically, science fiction was with me there from just about the earliest that I was able to read and onwards. Idea of writing science fiction kind of grew along the way and became a greater and greater part of that, although I did continue with the science background in college and got my doctorate in mathematics.
Well, that's very interesting, but if I may, let me ask you, how did it happen in that case then? You didn't just try and become a science fiction writer from the very beginning, but you kind of ended up being a professor of mathematics for about 30 years, as far as I know.
Yes.
And only towards the latter part of your sort of university or professorship career, I think you sort of started shifting your attention towards science fiction writing.
Science fiction writing was always a hobby of mine. And as I was teaching full time, that is, you know, academic year, there really wasn't time to write very much science fiction. It was mainly during the summer vacations or during the Christmas breaks that I was able to write science fiction. So similarly in graduate school, so from the end of high school until the year 2000, basically this was a hobby, a background thing. And as hobbies go, I rather recommend it, by the way, since there are many hobbies, most hobbies probably, that can become quite expensive. And in the case of writing, it doesn't have to be expensive at all, except of your time. And it has an upside. I mean, it's quite possible that what you do will be successful, and somewhat successful monetarily, but also from the standpoint of getting to see and people and talk about things that you wouldn't have had a chance to otherwise. So I'm very, very glad that I had the academic career. It certainly did dominate the work during those 25 or 30 years. I had the idea that when I retired from teaching that suddenly my writing output would go up correspondingly. And that's been one of the disappointments of the last 10 or 11 years, is that my writing production has probably increased somewhat, but it hasn't increased by the factor of four that one might expect from just the numerical ratio of times.
If I may say so, though, quantity is not everything. The quality of your writing is outstanding, so I think you're making up there at the very least.
Thank you.
I mean, you have a number of very influential books. I personally have read three of yours, and the latest one I read was Rainbow's End.
Yes.
But I started with the book where you coined the term the technological singularity, and this is how I got introduced to your work in general. So perhaps it is best to start the meat of our discussion here with the Werner Vinge definition of what the technological singularity stands for. Because you're the person who coined the term, and there's so many variations of it that I'd really like to get yours again here for the record.
Right. When I use that term, technological singularity, what I have in mind is the notion that in the relatively near future, we can talk about that, humankind will, using technology, either create or become creatures of superhuman intelligence. And there's various good reasons why singularity is a good metaphor in that circumstance, but it is a type of change, a technological change, that is qualitatively different from the technological changes that we have achieved in the past, mm-hmm. and it's different in the following sense: Singularity 1-on-1 could, by some magical way, interview Mark Twain. You could describe to Mark Twain what our era is like and what's going on in our era, and he would understand what you were saying. And I think actually Mark Twain would be quite enthusiastic about it because he really was a technophile.
He was a techno geek, yeah.
Yes, and you could actually do the same exercise with people from even further back, and
yeah.
You could describe our present situation to them as long as you had a common language, and it's very likely they wouldn't believe you, but they would understand what you were saying if mm-hmm. you could speak for an hour or two to them.
Mm-hmm.
That's been the form of technological change up till now, that changes were great, or that is large. They were generally unpredictable, certainly unpredictable in detail and often unpredictable in larger ways, but they could be explained to people from before the change. On the other hand, if you tried to do the same explanatory exercise with a goldfish, you probably would not be successful. If you tried to explain to a goldfish what was going on in our human world here today, you would not be able to do that. That is the difference in terms of talking about and explaining things post-singularity compared to now. It's not merely a matter of prediction. It's a matter of the fundamental thing about observing the world has changed, and so in that sense, the thinking of the term singularity as a metaphor. It's actually a kind of interesting metaphor by comparison with, say, the singularity in physics that we get, you know, near it with black holes, mm-hmm. in which not very much information can be extracted about what's going on inside a black hole.
That very much reminds me to the sort of a question metaphor of can a slug get Beethoven, and
yes.
how would Beethoven sound to a slug, for example? I mean, right? I mean, I'm sure that the slug in his own mind, or like I don't remember the number of neurons that they had, something like 50 or something like that. They would sort of perceive the sound waves
right.
as some kind of vibrations, right?
Right.
But would that really amount to getting it? Like,
right.
Probably
right.
not.
You can't take a slug to the opera.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely, yes, indeed. So let me backtrack just a little bit here and see how that fits then. So, what is the motivation behind your work then? I mean, you started as a child enthusiast of science fiction. You were a professor of mathematics for several decades. Then you devoted yourself full time to science fiction. You coined the term the technological singularity. What is this all leading towards? What's the motivation and what's the goal, if there is any in the end?
The personal goal, in a large sense, is just getting some, making some sense of the universe, plus the wish for an optimistic view of the universe. Because this, although thinking about things that might be smarter than us is a topic that you can get nervous about if you expect it to happen soon, it is also overall an optimistic view of progress. So when I was growing up in the 50s, in the 1950s, the notion of progress was there, and in the science fiction magazines, there was a real effort to try to understand or see the limits of progress. And the more I read, and I think the more writers looked at this, wider the horizons seemed to grow. So in by the late 1950s, in my personal evolution through this, I was looking for what sort of limits that there were on progress. And by that time, I have this great little book on my bookshelf, Automata Studies, edited by Claude Shannon and John McCarthy. And it really made an impression upon me at the time. And the first story that I ever, science fiction story that I ever wrote that sold, was about intelligence amplification. And toward the end of it, the cat is out of the bag in the sense that it looks like intelligence amplification technology is going to go public. And a guy who was trying to stop that effort, made the comment that this fellow was actually a general, a military general, mm-hmm. and he made the comment that I regard intelligence amplification as a true revolution in weapons, but it also puts the issue beyond the control of mere humans. And so, in a sense, my position in this story, the general says, is that of an anti-militarist. Now, in fact, if intelligence amplification were used for military goals, it certainly would be a military thing, and in a way, a type of showstopper. On the other hand, the military applications of superintelligence is really, if we can avoid the violence angle, the military implications is really among the smallest implications of superhuman intelligence for the mm-hmm. for the human race as a whole and for life in the universe as a whole.
I will come back to the military implications and the sort of negative potential scenarios of a singularity a bit later. But let me see how we can make sense of, or how I can make sense of what you just said in a single word. You said that you've been a seeker, a person who tries to make sense of the universe. If you are to put that in a single word, then would you say that you're a futurist, a singularitarian, a science fiction author, a professor and a teacher, a mathematician? Who is Werner Vinge in his own words?
I know people who would rise in rage at the idea of trying to reduce such to one word, since
it's a loaded like question.
Saying, tell me what this Encyclopedia Britannica says in one word.
Absolutely.
There are certain basic notions of bit economy or bit, lossy data compression. So having said that, and I wanted to frame that question in my answer with those words. But if you want one word, I would say the science fiction writer.
Mm-hmm. Science fiction writer, very interesting. So, since you were the science fiction writer who coined the term the technological singularity, and that was, I think, 30 some years ago in Marooned in Real Time.
Actually, let me say a little bit or modify that. Using the term, singularity in the sense that I am using it, the first time I did that was at an artificial intelligence conference at Carnegie Mellon. Mm-hmm. In just a second.
93?
In 1982.
Oh, 1982, yeah.
And then Omni magazine, there was an editor from Omni. I was on a panel. Actually, it was a panel with Marvin Minsky. And this just popped out when I was talking on the panel. And afterwards, one of the editors at Omni magazine came around and asked me if I would be interested in writing an op-ed piece about that, which I did. And then in the 80s, I wrote these two novels, The Peace War and Marooned in Real Time.
Mm-hmm.
And the singularity plays a background role, as you mentioned, in Marooned in Real Time. This, all through the 80s, then, when I'd go to science fiction conventions, I'd talk about this, and people would talk to me about this, and after these books came out, more people would talk to me. And this gave me about 10 years to sort of think about the notion, and also since I was usually talking to technological people,
mm-hmm.
mostly programmers, but there was really a lot of feedback and a lot of pointed questions. And so in a way, it worked out ideally, because in the early 90s, I was invited to talk at NASA, and I gave a talk about the singularity. Mm-hmm. But by that time, I'd gotten my act together. I had some nice examples. I had the sort of different paths to the singularity that we may talk about in this interview, but that are in my essay. And this meant that I took the talk that I gave and I made it into a printed essay, and it's on my, if you go to my pages at San Diego State University, you can find that. And that was in 1992 or 1993. And that's actually a very nice essay, and partly because I had 10 years to think about it. I think that essay stands up very well. In fact, if I just get approached casually about this, I just point to that essay, because there's virtually nothing in it that I would seriously disagree with at this point, and I said a lot of things right mm-hmm. in there. So that's kind of my history of the way I'm using that term.
It's a very classic essay indeed, and I only read it probably 3 or 4 years ago, and I was very impressed about the fact that it still holds perfectly well in time, and it's perfectly reasonable still, even actually perhaps more powerful than in the 90s, because the awareness, the public awareness of the probability of the singularity as a very high potentiality is much higher, I think, than in the 90s.
Right, now, I figure that as time goes forward, if some terrible disaster doesn't happen, I mean, if our world continues, that this is just going to become, until it happens, it's going to become kind of a part of the background wallpaper of modern culture. There is this notion about what this progress means, and probably more and more as time goes on, it fits more with what appears to be going on. And as in that sense, it just becomes sort of a steady drumbeat, background music or background wallpaper to how we look at things when it comes to progress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think as time goes by, it's much harder to dismiss than it was 10 or 15 years ago. And I think in another 5 or 10 years ago, it would be even harder to dismiss. So it gets to
and
be...
And even if a person, you know, even if it's not at the center of a particular person's notion of what's going to happen, it still is a way of looking at things. I think it's important when a person looks at the real world to have several, there are things you believe about the real world, but in trying to interpret what's happening from day to day, it's nice to have several different models, several different theories, when it comes to the singularity, which is what I think in this regard I think about the most, I have these different ways of singularity, you know, different trends toward the singularity. And as I watch events in the real world, pigeonholing them with regard to that model is actually very useful. Now, I also run other models. Another model is singularity is not going to happen. I actually gave a talk I'm quite proud of about that up at the Long Now a couple years ago. If you look for counter indicators, things, there are ways of looking at the world that when you look at it with that particular set of glasses on, you see things that you might not have seen otherwise. So I think it's, even if you don't believe all the theories that you encounter in the real world, it's good to have several of them that you think about carefully and use as filters occasionally to look at what's happening. And you may see things popping out of the background noise that you wouldn't have seen otherwise.
Yeah, yeah. And in a way, that says to me that you were successful in your search because you did manage to find, it seems to me successfully, a very powerful idea, which kind of really does make sense from the overall direction of things in the universe, I think. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it's certainly been helpful to me in the way I look at things myself.
And I mean, the way it's being picked up by a number of people, including myself, and now with Ray Kurzweil's documentaries coming up in the mainstream, and him and Barry Ptolemy kind of having this big public relations tour across the TV networks, radio stations, and so on, the idea comes more and more into the mainstream, I think.
It's a little bit like imagining what it would be what it was like in recognizing the Industrial Revolution. Now, in my opinion, the singularity is a much bigger thing than the Industrial Revolution.
Absolutely.
But the Industrial Revolution, as we talk about it nowadays, is spread over 150 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be interesting to kind of look as you progress through that time as an historical study to watch how commentators, the pace was much slower than it is now, but to watch how commentators, you know, woke up to the notion that something was happening and the sort of jargons that they applied to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
And that same sort of realization, I think, is happening here with computation and other things that have to do with thought.
Absolutely. So let me see if we can push that concept even further. You said it took you about 10 years until you managed to get it polished and sort of well-formed into your mind, and you published your classic 1993 paper. But have your concept evolved after that, from 1993 till 2011, for example? That's almost 20 years. Has anything changed for the last 20 years?
Well, the answer to that is a little bit embarrassing, because one of my rules of thumb is that if you see somebody who hasn't changed their ideas for 20 years, there's something wrong. So I'm embarrassed because, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, there's very little that I would have to complain about with the NASA essay for 93.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of things that or emphases that are different, I think really there are, and in fact, in the last 2 or 3 years, I have felt some changes, and it's really something that I would expect, that as time goes forward, let's suppose the singularity really is going to happen, as time goes forward, you get a better idea of what's happening. And as I think Charles Stross, the science fiction writer, has pointed out, as you move along toward it, if there is anything like added intelligence for the human race as a whole, which with the internet and with various features that effectively amplify our intelligence, it's quite possible that we will, as we move forward to it, actually have insights that were not possible before. Go ahead.
That's very interesting here. Let me just jump right in, because I'm also in a sort of email exchange with Charles Stross for an interview. And because I love his book, Accelerando, and I think it's one of the best singularity.
Oh, which book?
Accelerando. Which book?
Yes, he's actually, Charlie has written all sorts of super, super books, but that's certainly the premier singularity one that he's written, I think.
I think so too, but the most interesting thing was that in his email, he told me something which quite surprised me, and that was that he is more of a singularity skeptic for the last several years, because he told me, don't forget I wrote that book in 2004, and in the last several years I'm more of a singularity skeptic.
Your interview with him should be very interesting.
And then, I just can't wait to find out why. but that sort of also fits with your interesting statement that people most normally should change their ideas in time. And thus you felt a little uncomfortable that you haven't changed your mind on the singularity too much.
Right. I see. I have sort of, given that it's 2011, there's certain things that are going on that would make certain of the trends that I had in the paper seem like they're going better, and other ones may be going worse. So I do have the feeling that it's clear what is going on, but it's not a revolutionary change in the views that I had in the early 90s.
Let me grab this thought then and see, what are the markers, what are the indicators that what you had in mind is actually occurring or unfolding as we speak, that we're getting indeed closer towards the singularity, and so do you see those? What are those? And if not, then what would be the negative markers that we're not getting towards a singularity?
Right. Let me mention a background thing, is that the IEEE Spectrum had an issue dedicated to singularity in 2008, and they had a lot of essays in it by pro and con points of view,
mm-hmm.
and I highly recommend that. I had the enviable position of getting to write a sort of summary where I was able to talk about everybody else's essay. So it was a lot of fun for me, but I think it was a lot of fun for other people. And one thing I pointed out there, and which I pointed out in the 1993 essay, is these different paths to the singularity, and those are the particular. I watch my symptoms about the singularity relative to each of those. So let me just say roughly what those are. One is the classical artificial intelligence scenario. You make a mm-hmm. machine that's very smart, which would include, if it's running a mobile, it would include robots. Then there's intelligence amplification scenario that we use the computers to make ourselves as individuals superhumanly intelligent. And then there's the internet scenario, which is humanity and its networks and the computers and their databases. Altogether, the ensemble is superhumanly intelligent. And then I think all four of those were in the 93 essay. The next one that was in the 93 essay is an example of at least a change in emphasis. I mentioned it in just a single sentence in the 93 essay, but I've come to regard it as quite important, and that is something I call the digital Gaia scenario,
mm-hmm.
and that is that the network of embedded microprocessors becomes sufficiently powerful as to be considered a superhuman being, and that's going like gangbusters. I mean, that's just the whole thing you see with individual devices are not especially smart, but when they are embedded in most of the physical technological artifacts of our world, mm-hmm. you get something that is extraordinarily powerful. So
that's like the swarm theory, isn't it? Or the swarming, right? The individual ants are not very smart.
The individual ants are not very smart. The ensemble is very, very smart. And in fact, you're familiar, I am sure, with the rapture of the nerds mm-hmm. characterization of the singularity.
It's my next question, actually. So it's perfect.
Let me the notion, which I think most of your listeners are also familiar with, is a very amusing criticism of the people who argue for the singularity, is that it's just a religious apocalypse dressed up in technological garb. and the phrase "the singularity is rapture for the geeks," is a beautiful summary of that pointed argument. And I've had interesting encounters with journalists who make this point. But I think that the digital Gaia shows that when you talk about the singularity, you are talking about events, namely the rise of superhuman intelligence, that might lead one to make religious sounding things, religious sounding comments. But that's really a reflection more of its size and importance than it is a criticism. And in fact, the digital Gaia would probably not be at all like the apocalypse. It would, if you want to, make analogies with existing religions, the analogy would be with animism.
Mm-hmm.
That the world wakes up and that the objects in the world have a spirit of their own. In fact, another person to interview there would be Carl Schroeder. Is that a fellow? Schroeder.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Canadian science fiction writer who has written some really cool novels about the notion of the world itself waking up via fine grain distribution, and also
smart
the notion
dust
that,
and so on.
Say again.
Smart dust.
Smart dust is one term for that, which is really just sort of a more extreme version of just having lots of embedded processors.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't necessarily look like a swarm of killer ants coming at you. I mean, it's just the universe. Reality becomes its own database, and reality wakes up. And it's certainly not a thinking thing like you and I. If it has any analogy to human past and human philosophy, it would be to things like animism. And one other thing that I think Schroeder has brought up in his stories is that if you look at it that way, you also have to sort of acknowledge that there could be types of mind that are unequivocally very, very, very powerful, but that they don't think at all like we do. And I think the digital Gaia actually gives some hint of what that sort of situation might be like. In any case, if you look at the broad spectrum of the variety of things that we can sort of imagine, it definitely is a good indication that we're talking about something that is not easily amenable to projection and prediction, such as we've talked about in the past technologies.
Let me go a little bit deeper here on sort of the negative benchmarks towards the singularity, and precede that by mentioning that I recently watched a couple of videos with Jeroen Lanier, who wrote a book or a manifesto called "You're Not a Gadget," and I'm also scheduling an interview with him soon. But in those two videos, he argues very sort of determinately that the singularity is a pure form of a new religion. And he
a pure form of what?
A totally new religion. And he goes and he traces it back to sort of the tragedy of Alan Turing and his, you know, eventual suicide, you know, being forced upon him after, you know, being treated with female hormones to cure, quote unquote, his homosexuality, and how he wrote the Turing test in the last couple of years of his life, and how from there on we sort of have this changed mythology, you know, where it used to be Adam and Eve, but right now we replaced Eve with a computer in the Turing test, sort of it expresses the hidden desire of one overcoming one's sexuality, one's body, and one's death. And and therefore the sort of epitome of that idea culminates in the idea of the singularity, and it turns into a major religion. And he was going on why it exhibits all the specific features of all the other religions, including intolerance, according to him. Well, I'm not sure that intolerance is the exact word that he used, but in that sense that we are as sort of, in a way, close-minded to alternative points of view as you know, fundamentalists in other religions. So let me ask you this. First, maybe you want to comment a little bit on that, but secondly, perhaps you can connect that with the negative benchmarkers or markers that could be showing that we're wrong, that the singularity is not coming and indeed would be just an idea and would remain so.
Right. Well, first of all, I hope you do get to interview with Jeroen. I think he really is one of the most articulate of the of the speakers. You know, contrary to the sorts of points that singularity people make. When I look for negative things, and by negative I mean symptoms that the singularity is not going to happen. Okay. By the way, my current situation is that I still figure that I'd be surprised if it doesn't happen if it does not happen by 2030. Or actually, I would modify that with assuming we don't get some big war or something. Science fiction writers have classically avoided having to talk about the singularity by putting some physical disaster in the way, slowing down technological progress. And, you know, so leaving that such possibilities aside, I think the singularity is the most likely scenario for the relatively near future. But it's also possible that even in the absence of a disaster, that it still would not happen in, you know, within any sort of reasonable time. And that's what my talk at Long Now was about. So looking at that sort of restricted set of possibilities, as a science fiction writer and as a scenario writer, one way of generating these counter symptoms is to imagine that the year is 2050 and you're writing, and you've been commissioned to write an essay why it was obvious all along that the singularity would not happen. And, you know, in that case, you drop these symptoms, and there are things to that you can watch for. And it seems to me that the most important thing to watch for is the possibility that we just never figure out how to put the parts together. In other words, one of the strongest arguments for the singularity is this notion that is Moore's law, and the notion that that human thought is ultimately substrate independent, and that we can do it on silicon, and we're making the silicon faster and faster, and eventually we'll, if we can figure out how to put the parts together, eventually make something as smart as a human, and then, in a sense, much more importantly, something that's a lot, since we can already make people that are as smart as humans, that's already mm-hmm. doable, has been for thousands of years. but if we can do that on silicon, then it's pretty plausible we can do something smarter just by, if nothing else, turning up the clock rate. So one critical symptom or anti-symptom to watch for is failures to manage large software projects, failures to handle the levels of coordination that have to go on in order to have thinking things. And so one thing I actually do watch for is progress and non-progress in software engineering.
Mm-hmm.
All through the 80s, whenever I talked about this to programmers, they would make the point that, you know, this talk about Moore's Law is fine, but the Moore's Law for software engineering, you know, the growth rate for the effectiveness of software engineering is nothing like the hardware rate. In fact, I'm not sure anybody has written it up, but there is the I did write it up in my talk at Long Now, is you could imagine, and I only say this facetiously, a sort of Murphy's law has a corollary to address Moore's law. and the corollary is that the software is so hard to do that the ability to use the hardware only grows as the log of the hardware power.
Yeah.
So that means that basically every Moore's law generation, you know, you get just the increment of the log of the improvement of the hardware. So basically, you just sort of lumber along in a linear way. And if one looks at what you can do with a 2 gigahertz, 1 gigabyte RAM processor in our era, and compare that with what you could do with a 1980. 8086. It certainly doesn't seem like a million times improvement mm-hmm. in many non-numerical sorts of ways. So I have a long list of terrible software disasters that could turn people away from, you know, the money here, the money that is driving the progress. Basically, one of the fundamental things about why the computer stuff has been going so well for so long is that, unlike a better mousetrap, which only attracts funding from one source, the people who have too many mice,
mm-hmm.
The computer business is something that has 360 degrees of demand. Almost anything that humans are doing, and certainly anything of an economic nature, mm-hmm.
Can be improved by computers, yeah.
Big time,
yeah.
By every improvement in computation.
Yeah.
And this means that the payoff is incremental.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm still a super big fan of spaceflight stuff, but the spaceflight has not been able to give us the sort of revenue payoff per small incremental investment
mm-hmm.
that the computer stuff has. So you have that combination of kind of universal profitability plus incremental profitability. And that is the thing that has just driven this so hard. So if you could break that,
mm-hmm.
if you could imagine something that would break that combination, and one possibility would be if you begin to get either very large software disasters or the black hat angle on the internet got to be so bad, you know, what is the spam level of internet traffic right now?
I think 80% or something.
I've heard numbers like 80%.
Yeah.
And it is just a tribute to the awesome progress that we're doing that's survivable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it is very, in fact, it's been very well survivable. The internet is still is a growing and a thing that can still justify all sorts of hype. I think, in fact, the era of hype for, my whole point, I guess, is that the era of hype for computation and automation and networking is ongoing and is well justified. But negative symptom would be you begin to see disasters that are failures of integration that are large enough so that there is not a payoff to you know, setting up the next large progress. And if that happened, then you get a ripple back into the economic drivers behind the technological improvements. So you could imagine a sort of leveling off. In fact, I've written stories where it does level off. And if you think along those lines, probably the last thing to level off would be very simple improvements in semiconductor integration. So probably the last thing to level off would be improvements in memory size.
Mm-hmm.
So I had this vision, which actually executed in Deepness in the Sky, where eventually you could get a laptop that would have all the software that had ever been written on it. And it could run it all via emulators at one speed or another. So then if you come across a project that you have to do, this is like 10,000 years of legacy software then.
Mm-hmm.
If you come across a project that you have to do that involves software, you have a choice that actually we have right now, but it would be much more intense. That is, do you go laptop diving or do you try to write new code? And the thing is, what you're trying to do would almost certainly be in there, and it would be done as well as anything you could think of. But in order to interface it with whatever your current situation is, would be an amount of work that might be as large as writing the thing anew.
Mm-hmm. Werner, we have about 10-15 minutes or so left from our interview, and I'm going to try to squeeze in the other three or four questions that I have for you. So let me see if I can wrap this part of our discussion up with the question about your estimate about our chances of surviving the singularity. I mean, Ray Kurzweil is often criticized for being too optimistic, and I myself here get surprised quite often by people I interview who give me surprisingly low estimates. For example, Michael Onisimo from the Singularity Institute gave me 25%. George Dvorsky, who is a Canadian transhumanist, gave us less than 2%. What, in your opinion, is the estimate that we would survive the singularity?
If the singularity happens.
Yeah.
I think singularity is certainly the most likely non-catastrophic thing that could happen to us. I think the chances of First of all, the human race, if you look at other species, the idea that it would still be around as it is now, 1 million years from now or 10 million years from now, you know, by past standards of paleontology, that's very unlikely. So if that's what a person means about the human race surviving, then I think the human race is going to grow into something better. So the question comes down to, is one talking about that something better that we become?
Yeah.
Or is it, okay, the alternative to talk about, you know,
my presumption is that if we survive, we would have to change fundamentally, right? But there still would be continuity between what we are and what we would have become.
And I think that's very high probability. And in fact, spin this discussion back to 1930.
Mm-hmm.
In 1930, there would be people who would talk about, you know, sometime 100,000 years from now, we humans, the culmination of all our dreams of social progress and intellectual progress and technological progress, maybe 1 million years from now, we'll become something better. And everybody would get a nice warm feeling about that. You know, very few people would be upset by that. It's the prospect that it might happen before you retire that makes people get all nervous.
Uh-huh.
So, viewed in that context, I think it's very unlikely that assuming the singularity happens, it's very unlikely that it would make the human race extinct. If you're talking about Homo sapiens 1.0,
2.0 maybe after the singularity.
But yeah, if we let's talk about the survival of Homo sapiens 1.0.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the standard, unaugmented. I think there would still be actually a significant place for such as you and me are now. Now, the general reason is a matter of safety.
Mm-hmm.
Look at it this way: if you're a superhuman intelligence, you know, with a big silicon component or whatever, you know, non-biological component, you have to consider the possibility of existential threat yourself. And one thing to realize about the universe is Mother Nature can be pretty brutal. We live in a universe that has disasters at all scales.
Yeah.
And if you were such a supermind, you'd have to consider the possibility that some dark and rainy night, some disaster might come along and wipe you and all your silicon-assisted or silicon-constructed brethren out of existence. Now, think about that situation. What are the chances that if there are no people like Werner and Nicola 1.0, if there are no people like normal humans around, living in a biological situation, what are the chances that machines would ever arise spontaneously? Zero.
Yeah.
Very near to zero, probably, I think.
Yeah.
On the other hand, what are the chances humans, say, even without technology, if they were still around, even without technology, but with their own biological infrastructure, you know, the natural world, with green stuff in it, what are the chances that we would make the machine skin? I'll tell you, actually, the chances are near one.
Yeah.
If it can be done. And that's not necessarily because we love machines so much. It's just that we can't help ourselves.
Yeah. Absolutely.
We go out and tinker and we make things. And eventually, in a very short geological period of time, the big brains would be back in business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let me ask you then, since we've mentioned Werner and Nicola 1.0 and 2.0, let me ask you this very personal question. Now, you have been, philosophically speaking, at the cutting edge of technology and science fiction. Yet, we are talking over an old-fashioned landline, and in your own email to me, you sort of self-admitted that you're very, quote, I am very low-tech here.
Right.
So how do you square this? How do you explain this? Isn't that sort of paradoxical that Werner Vinge, the person who coined the term the technological singularity, is self-admittedly very low-tech and doesn't use Skype even, and so on?
Actually, that is as we're running out of time here, that actually is a very fairly large topic. One part of it is that we didn't touch on it in this talk, in this interview, is I have lots of misgivings about I'm really have not participated in the social networking stuff. Despite the book Rainbow's End, that is one angle of participation in technology that I have not done.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is that I just don't have the attention time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is that I think a trend that is bad is that if you get a big positive feedback from doing something, and if the risks of doing it, and I'm not talking about singularity risks here at this time, but the risks of doing it are unquantified, it's very easy to convince yourself to do more and more of this behavior that's rewarding. And the whole thing with losing privacy and financial privacy, and this I think is the risks are underestimated.
Mm-hmm.
And that one thing that they that has been found, I think, with simple embezzlement is that automation actually makes embezzlement much rarer, but the ticket price of each event becomes much larger.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, once
the damage is greater.
Right. I think that the great danger, and it's especially epitomized by the digital Gaia scenario,
mm-hmm.
is that it transforms the universe into something where anything can happen. In other words, what would it be like if the physical universe were as unpredictable as financial market?
Mm-hmm.
So in interviewing Taleb, the guy who wrote the Black Swan,
mm-hmm.
would be something I think you'd find very interesting. I don't know whether that's a book that you have
I've heard about the book.
Yeah, it's actually a very important book.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, if the world got transformed into a place, and it is being this is happening, where basically exponent overflow can happen about real world issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just for inside your computer; it's also for things having to do with everyday life. That actually makes a person very uneasy, and I have all sorts of concerns about how that is being put into place.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, what I think and hope will happen is that we'll get the frictional, that is the bad things that could happen, will happen at a rate that they can be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a way, what we're going through is 50 million years, the equivalent of 50 or 400 million years of biological evolution. We're going through it in a matter of 40 or 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you really have to be on your toes. And basically, I'm cautious enough that I'm not one of the first adopters.
But aren't you scared you're going to get left behind?
Ah, a real possibility.
Because that's the upside is, you get to keep your privacy and your safety in that sense. But the downside is that you wouldn't be riding the wave.
Right. And I've often wondered, for instance, it's almost a cliche that young people are totally cavalier,
mm-hmm.
about their own privacy.
Absolutely.
And to me, that means one of two things: either they're not clear on the principle, they're making a serious mistake. Either that's one, or they realize that in 10 or 15 years they'll be running the show,
mm-hmm.
and society is going to change.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another set of interviews, like with David Brin and the Transparent Society type stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You could imagine a different society where these things are just taken in a different way. And the fact that there's some real strange clip of you on YouTube somewhere, when you're 17,
mm-hmm.
18, that really just doesn't count.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring our interview here to a close with the second last question, which is, I know you were writing a book last time when we were exchanging emails. Perhaps you'd be willing to share a little bit about your latest project with us, and we will
yes.
be able to get it off the shelves.
I am just, as we speak, I am finishing up correcting the second pass page proofs to my novel, The Children of the Sky, which actually is now visible for pre-order on Amazon. And this is a sequel to my novel, A Fire Upon the Deep.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes place about 10 years later. It takes place entirely on the Tynes world, which is where most of A Fire Upon the Deep took place.
Mm-hmm. And you said it's available to pre-order on Amazon, but when do you expect it would ship?
Oh, yeah, the publication date is some date in October 2011, so this year.
Mm-hmm. Great. I'm looking forward to get my hands on it and read it.
Great.
Excellent. All right. So usually I have the habit of closing my interview with the last question, which is, if you have one single message to our listeners today, what would you like it to be?
I think an exhortation to optimism and intelligent involvement in what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to elaborate on that a little bit in a couple?
No, chiefly because then we would go on for some time more. But basically, there are all sorts of terrible things that can happen. You know, the future cannot be predicted. There's all sorts of terrible things that can happen. In my opinion, the most likely those terrible things are very mundane, like war.
Mm-hmm.
That the things that we are concerned about for most part in this interview have enormous upsides. They are worth the attention of people who have any intellectual interests at all, and there's probably some varieties of them that are of concern. But overall, we are in a situation where we can surpass the wildest dreams of optimism of previous generations. And in fact, that's the chief source of the nervous making, I think. If you really start thinking that you can get everything that's ever been dreamed of, then you have to start looking at what those dreams were. Because if you come down to implementing some of them, you're confronted with definitions that you finally have to get clear about.
Mm-hmm. So we can surpass the wildest dreams of optimism. I like that.
Yeah, I am very happy every time I see, you know, every time I see all the wonderful things that are happening in this area.
Fantastic. Well, on this note, then I would like to thank Werner Vinge for taking over an hour of his time today to be with us. Thank you very much,
okay,
Werner.
Okay, thanks, Nicola.